From PowerlineBlog.com and produced by Ricochet.com, this is The Powerline Show with your host, Steve Hayward.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to episode 95 of The Powerline Show. Actually, this is a special early edition. Normally, lately, we have been coming out with the show over the weekend in time for your Monday morning commute or late Sunday afternoon walk in the woods. But I've got a bit of a scoop here late this week. I managed to pin down Henry Olson, election analyst extraordinaire, and get some of his late-breaking thoughts on how things are going to play out in the election next Tuesday. Now, every 2 years, Henry puts together a very detailed prediction, in many cases race by race, of how he thinks the election is going to turn out, which he posts on National Review Online, usually on Sunday night or Monday, the day before the election. He's not quite ready to make his specific calls yet. He's waiting for the last batch of data to roll in from the various pollsters and whatnot over the weekend, and he did agree, though, to sit down and talk with us about where things stand right now. We also ask a few questions about the latest election results from overseas, especially Germany and Brazil, where you're also seeing, quote-unquote, populism and nationalism at work. And finally, we talk a little bit about baseball, because Henry has some very specific ideas on how the game can be improved, and his ideas are way better than a lot of the ones I've been seeing tossed around, like, you know, only giving a team two outs or putting a runner on second base in extra innings and other crazy, stupid things like that. In any event, sit back, relax, and take in Henry Olson with the survey of the political landscape here just a few days before the crucial midterm election. Well, hi, Henry. Great to catch up to you here on not quite election-y, but we just have a few days to go. Before we talk about the American scene, which I know is your greatest specialty, you follow everything. And in the last few days, we've seen some fresh election results out of Germany, making it look like the end of Angela Merkel is in sight. And then also Brazil, where another so-called populist candidate, what Bolsonaro is his name, has won in something like a landslide. And of course, the press is freaking out, which makes me think he's probably got some redeeming qualities. But I know you're following those. What are your takeaways from what we're seeing overseas in the last week?
Yeah, well, with respect to Germany, we really are seeing the end of Angela Merkel. That what Germany is doing is the dissolution and fracturing of politics that is roiling the rest of the world has finally come to Germany. And for exactly the same reason is that the ins, the establishment, tends to want to either avoid or ignore the questions that the public wants answered. And the German Grand Coalition is falling apart because of that. Voters are moving towards one of the two extremes to answer those questions, either open borders or closed borders. So Merkel may survive through next year, but Germany's politics are changing just like they are everywhere else. And that means for the next year, at least, Europe is going to be incredibly unstable.
One more question about Germany before we switch to Brazil. What I've read just from the headlines, and I haven't delved into the details, is that the alternative for Germany, the AfD party, seems to have hit a bit of a ceiling. And at least in Bavaria a couple weeks ago, you saw a big uptick for the Green Party. What do you make of all of that? Is that correct, by the way? And what do you make of all
that? No, it's absolutely correct. You know, first, what we tend to see throughout the West is that blue-collar protest parties do hit a ceiling unless they become something more. And that ceiling, it depends on the country, but it's usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 50, you know, between the low teens and 20%. And that's exactly where AfD is. They've got their vote. And depending on the state, they'll be a little higher or a little bit lower. You know, in East Germany, where people are much poorer, they will be in the 20s. But they've got what they're going to get unless they adapt. And
is that your phone? It's not mine.
Yes, it is my phone. And I don't know who's calling me.
That's okay.
It's...
AFD we were talking about.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to get rid of this.
Yeah, no problem. Right. It's probably a robocall anyway from a pollster.
No, it's not. It's somebody else, and I don't know who it is. It's a Washington number, and, you know. Anyway, I'm getting a lot of press calls, as you can
imagine. I'll bet.
So back to AFD. You know, they've got what they're going to get, and unless they enlarge, they're not going to get significantly more. But they're also not going to get significantly less. And that's what the parties in Germany need to recognize, is that there is no coalition on the right that does not include AfD. That if you want to have a center-right coalition anywhere in the Western world, you have to include blue-collar protest parties to do that. What the Greens are doing is they are essentially becoming less greeny and more open bordery. They are the place where center-left people who would like to have a general progressive, modern, in their view, globalized world are coming to roost, and where the German version of the Romney-Clinton voter, the moderate person who's open to the right but on identity issues identifies with the center-left, are coming home. And that means that the Greens are really now the second party in Germany. They are dominating in cities, and the younger, educated voter is the voter they're picking up. There was something in, we're talking about the Hessian elections that were on Sunday. There was a statistic on the German public radio television station AfD that's showed old men in the countryside supported the CDU by large margins. Young women in the city supported the Greens. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
Yeah, sure it does. And darn, we've got Hessians again.
Yeah, and the problem is they didn't fall asleep. They came out to vote, so.
Right. Okay, now do Brazil.
Yeah, so Brazil, you know, what's really going on there shouldn't surprise people, in the sense that we know from now a century of democratic history that when people go through economic deprivation and a sense of insecurity to their persons, that they will embrace radical change. Brazil's been going through a record deep recession, and crime, which has always been endemic and high, is going through the roof. And the traditional parties are also engaged in self-dealing and corruption. And the trip, you know, this is the holy trinity of political revolution. And Bolsonaro is nothing other than somebody who is who these voters turn to when the alternative is more of the same, that all of the alternative incumbent parties have lost credibility. And he's the one who says, I can make it different. And is he a neo-fascist, or is he just somebody who bends with the winds and has social conservative streaks? You know, we'll find out. But the fact is, when incumbents can't deal with the situation and can't deliver on the basics that people expect their governments to do, you shouldn't expect people to want them in power again.
Right, right, yeah. All right, let's switch here to the home front. I know that's a very volatile scene, as always, before an election like this one, maybe more so than usual. I keep seeing headlines that the generic ballot is jumping up and down, and I've seen a couple of headlines saying it's tightened again lately. What's your rough sense of things right now? I know you want to wait for, you know, one more set of data through the weekend, but what's your rough sense right now on the generic ballot and where the House and Senate stand?
Yeah, the funny thing is each individual poll varies wildly, but in fact, the margin has been surprisingly constant now. That Democrats in November of last year led by 8 points, and today they lead by 7.6. The fact is that the Democrats are energized, as we know, to hate everything Republican and everything Trump. And there are millions of people, largely independent, Republican-leaning, formerly women, who are also energized to hate everything Republican and Trump. And that coalition has held relatively steady all year. And there's no reason to think that it's not going to hold steady going into Election Day. The problem for the Democrats is that is a very geographically concentrated coalition. It is a coalition that is strong in educated suburban and urban areas. And since most of the media and elites live in those areas, they see it around them and they say, well, you know, this is what's happening in the country. But the fact is, it's not the entire country. And that's one reason why I think Democratic gains will be large, but not super large.
Well, now let me ask you about some of the chatter the last few days about early voting. We've seen these numbers out of Florida and Arizona and one or two other places of higher than the last couple cycles early voting by Republicans, which everyone says, Karl Rove and the Wall Street Journal says, this is a good sign. On the other hand, could some of those be Republican women who are disaffected with Republicans because of Trump, who may be turning out early but voting the other way?
I think there's a lot of Republican grasping at straws right now. There is a slight Republican trend that I'm going to write about, that over the last month, Trump's approval is up, that GOP ballot, not nationally, but in a lot of key districts, is slightly up, and that incumbents or Republican candidates who a month ago were running ahead of national numbers are now running behind national numbers. So I look at that and I say, unless birthright citizenship or the contretemps of the weekend are going to be a big thing, and I suspect they will not, then people who decide late tend to go to the party that they came from. And the party that they are coming from increasingly is Republican. But there are so many seats that that doesn't apply to, that even if the Democrats fall back, they should probably still gain 23 seats in the House, win a lot of these governorships, win a lot of state legislative seats in highly educated areas that Republicans held at the beginning of the decade but are now shifting underneath them. Of course, this doesn't apply to the Senate because most of the states that are up don't have a lot of those voters in them, which is one reason I think we're going to see a split decision. Democrats everywhere but the Senate, but a wave of red in the Senate.
So do you have a top five races that you think are the most interesting or close, or I'm not sure how to put it, but do you have a top five?
I think there's indicative races. In the Senate, the cusp races for me are Indiana and Arizona. That if the Republicans win Indiana, and that will be one of the first states, Indiana, most of Indiana closes at 6 o'clock Eastern. So it'll be one of the first states we'll have a read on. That's a very good sign for Republicans. It's a Republican state, but the Democrats have been running strong in the polls. If the Republican can win there, that's a good sign for Republicans. Arizona, on the other hand, it's the flip side, is that if Sinema, the Democrat, wins, that suggests that the Republican gains in the Senate will be non-existent or minimal. Whereas if McSally wins, not only is there no chance for the Democrats to control the Senate, but rather it suggests a pretty sizable Republican gain. So those are two states, things I'm looking at. On the House, what I want to do is look at Pennsylvania 1. That is a finely crafted seat with a popular non-scandal-tarred Republican incumbent, but it's a seat that tilts to Clinton. If Brian Fitzpatrick can win there, that's, again, a suggestion that maybe the Democrats aren't going to conquer all before them. And then you've got seats like Ohio 12 and North Carolina 9, seats that lean Republican, but either have a big suburb in them, like Ohio 12 in Columbus, or have a difficult candidate like Mark Harris in North Carolina. If Democrats can pick up those seats, despite the fact that they shouldn't, that's going to suggest a better night than I'm thinking right now for Democrats.
Are there any potential surprises that are plausible to you, like Menendez losing in New Jersey or even Ted Cruz having the scare of his life and barely winning in Texas, let alone losing? Is there are any out there that you think you wonder might possibly flip in a way you're not expecting?
I think the Menendez thing, he's obviously weak. There's obviously a lot of people who would prefer another choice. But in the world of binary voting, I think he's going to win with a narrower than expected election. I would be quite surprised if we are talking about that as neck and neck at the 10 o'clock hour. And similarly with Cruz, is that Beto may be inspiring more fandom on the YouTube than anybody since Barack Obama. But if he comes closer than 5 points, I'll be pretty surprised. 5 points in a state like Texas is already close enough for comfort. If he were to come closer than that, I just think Republicans are going to be in for a really bad night. On the Republican side, the state that I'm looking for as a surprise is Montana, which is that John Tester only won re-election there against a weak incumbent with 48% of the vote. He's been polling in the mid-40s. The Republican hasn't broken through, but he hasn't dropped through the floor. If there's a Republican movement, it's going to show itself there as far as the surprise is concerned. So I'll be looking at Montana later in the evening.
Let's talk about governor's races, which are beginning not as much attention as Congress, of course, because Congress is connected to Trump in the national scene. But you have a lot of Republican incumbents on the ballot and successions like the Florida race. So Scott Walker is trying for what, his third term,
fourth election because of the recall.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen polls showing that neck and neck.
I'm going to take a really closer look at the governor's races later. I've been following the federal races like most people. I am very bearish on Republican chances in the governorships. And that's largely because there's a lot of Republican incumbents or successions, as you call them, in traditionally blue or purple states. And we have a mood in the country that is against the Republicans. We have states that are finely balanced that would require a mood neutrally or in favor of the Republicans to feel optimistic from a Republican standpoint. So I look at these close purple races like Ron DeSantis and Andrew Gillum in Florida or Tony Evers and Scott Walker in Wisconsin. I know the Republicans are going to win a couple of them, but everything that I experience tells me they're going to lose the vast majority of them. And it's not going to be a good night in the governor's chairs for Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like Michigan and Illinois are pretty much
Illinois goners. Has been gone. You know, Bruce Rauner is going to get under 40% of the vote, and the conservative insurgent will be in the high single digits. Michigan's been a goner all along. New Mexico's been a goner all along. And then you've got the states that are close. You've got Florida, you've got Ohio, you've got Wisconsin, you've got Iowa, you've got Nevada. You know, all of those are states, are purple states, and all of them the race is too close for comfort, with the Democrats ahead in every single one of them except Nevada. And then you've got Kansas, where in 2014, there was massive polling error. The polls showed Sam Brownback was going to lose, and he won narrowly. And now the polls are showing it neck and neck. If there's polling error again, then Kris Kobach will slip through narrowly. But again, it looks like Kansas may very well be a red state that flips blue.
One of the races that governor's races that interests me, because I, you know, went to college there and still spend a lot of time there, is Oregon, which is thought to be, you know, a West Coast left coast state, right? Home of Portlandia. And you have this fellow from Bend, Newt Bueller. I had dinner with him a year ago, and, you know, he's handsome. He's got a goatee. I won't say he's soft spoken, but he's not a rabble rouser. And so he's easy for, I think, a lot of swing voters to be comfortable with. And when you think about the trouble going on in Portland, and, you know, I had dinner once with Mayor Ted Wheeler a few years ago and thought he was a sensible guy, but he's turning out to be totally feckless with the street scene in Portland. And I'm thinking, gosh, a lot of suburban voters in the Portland area and Willamette Valley are going to say, you know, maybe we ought to have a Republican governor. Haven't had one in Oregon for more than 30 years now. And so I'm wondering if Newt Bueller is going to sneak up on us. One last thing about Newt I learned about. He, unlike Beto O'Rourke, he doesn't want any national publicity. He's actually turned away interview requests from some conservative magazines and conservative journalists, which I think is very shrewd on his part. Anyway, are you watching Oregon?
I am watching a little bit. You know, part of me is kind of hoping, just from a humor standpoint, that he wins, because Republican gains are going to be virtually non-existent. And if it's him, then, you know, the answer to the question, which Republican won the governorship in the massive 2018 wave. Anyone? Anyone? Bueller. But, right, you know, it is a close race. This is, however, again, a state that leans blue in a year that leans blue. And I'll be surprised if Bueller wins. I won't be surprised that he comes close for exactly the reasons that you talk about. But there's a lot of people who just want to send a message to Donald Trump. And there's going to be some poor city councilman with an R by his or her name, you know, sitting in some tiny town in Ohio who's going to lose because of that sort of anger. And I think that's the sort of thing that will hold him back, that in a different year, in a different era, he might be able to come through. And again, when somebody does well unexpectedly, that usually means they get a second look, a second bite at the apple. And 2022 may look very different for Newt Bueller than 2018, and no one will want to challenge him if he wants to take it a second bite.
Yeah. Say, you mentioned one thing very briefly here a few minutes ago that I want to take us back to, and that is, in fact, this fight that's erupted in the last 48 hours over birthright citizenship. I know since you're trained as a lawyer, you know or may have some opinions on the issue itself, but how do you think this is going to play out politically? I thought you said you didn't think it was going to have that much of an effect.
The reason I don't think it'll have much effect is because it is so late in the day. And because people, as we saw with the Kavanaugh hearings, are seeing the world through partisan lenses, that people will are so tuned into their team that they are making excuses or making arguments that are consistent with their team loyalty. But that said, ending the race on immigration, I've always thought was a good thing for Trump because it unites the Republican base voter who is still with the party, you know, not the Romney Clinton voter who abandoned it. You know, they're not coming home. You're not making a play with this for Orange County. You're making a play with this for Texas, for the people there and for Montana and those places. But the problem with birthright citizenship is that the middle of America would like, forgetting the bases on both sides, the middle of America would like to enforce the law and be compassionate. And the idea of birthright citizenship, I would think, has the potential of falling on the, oh, that's mean, kind of like the separation of kids at the border. We want the border enforced, but why can't we keep families together? You know, we want to have people here, but why should we penalize the kids? Now, in the 48 hours, I haven't really seen something that strikes me as breaking through. There's a lot of intellectual back and forth, and there's the usual, oh, Trump is so far out there, how could we possibly do it? Little focus on the human side. And that may very well mean that even if it was potentially harmful, it's not going to be harmful. But it's not the way I would want to be talking about immigration to rally the Trump coalition in the final 4 days, because there are people getting up who say, I want the illegals to go home. There are people getting up who say, I never want to have to deal with an amnesty again. There's not a whole lot of people getting up in the morning and saying, let's deal with the anchor baby problem. That's an extreme view, not the broad immigration control camp view. And it's not the way I would want to be ending this election if I were Trump.
Yeah. Okay, a couple of exit questions here. One is every 2 years you do about 24 or 36 hours out, a very detailed forecast of how you expect individual races to fall along with the general layout, some of which you've laid out here, and usually do that for National Review Online. Is that the plan this year? And when can listeners expect to go find
it posted again, on there? I will be furiously writing Saturday and Sunday. It will, depending on their publishing schedule and my ability to finish, either go up Sunday, late Sunday afternoon or evening, or very early Monday morning. Certainly by 7 a.m. Eastern time Monday morning, you'll have it up on National Review Online and be able to see what I think is going to happen on Tuesday night.
Great. And then I'll link to it at Powerline. And then, speaking of scorecards, in a completely different domain, and to get out of politics for a minute, Am I right in thinking that Dave Roberts has now mismanaged his second World Series in a row? That's certainly my impression.
The biggest for this whole series, not just the series, but the whole playoff, seeing managers go to the bullpen all the time approach strikes me as the wrong approach. It's not that there wasn't an old sense of the starters just got to tough it out that was overdone. But in game four, a must-win game for the Dodgers, Rich Hill was cruising. He wasn't at 100 pitches yet. He had a four-run lead. It was one out, one on. Why are you putting a tired bullpen that just pitched an 18-inning game less than 24 hours before? Why not let the fresh guy at least put a couple of guys on before you do it? Because who knows, maybe he gets out of the inning and then you can go to Kenley Jansen for two, which I think was his plan all along, and just let your arms rest. I think that was a bad decision, and it obviously cost the Dodgers any chance of winning the series. The Red Sox, you win 108 games during season. You're in one of the top 10 regular season teams of all time. Top 10 regular seasons of all time win the World Series at least half the time. So you always had to figure that they are a team of history and had consequently the better odds at winning. But, not trusting a guy who's cruising and putting in a tired arm just strikes me as a bonehead move of the first order.
Well, I understand the new theory of limiting pitch counts for your starting pitchers. You know, these people you're paying $25 million a year to during the regular season. But it seems to me in the postseason, it would be better for a whole bunch of reasons. You just mentioned one, a pitcher who's doing well like Rich Hill in game four. It seems to me that just as a general matter, if you've got a star pitcher who's doing well, leave the person in. They've got the offseason to rest their darn arms. And, I can remember, it's not that long ago, I think it was 1992, what year was it? There was when Jack Morris pitched 10 innings in game seven of the World Series and won.
It was the 1991 game seven. I think he went 10 and John Smoltz won nine, and it was a double shutout.
Right. Right. And what a thrilling thing to watch. And that's so much better than watching a platoon of all these relief pitchers come through.
Yeah, I was thinking about that on the way in this morning, actually. And I'm thinking of after the midterms of writing a piece, that what analytics showed in the 1980s is that the best way to win a baseball game was to focus on things that traditionally had not been focused on. You want strikeout pitchers. You want defenses that play each individual differently. And you want hitters that go for the long ball, because it's very hard to string multiple hits together. And it's there's a lot of risk involved in manufacturing outs. And it's much more efficient to do what I call, they call the three true outcomes, which I call wham, walk, or whiff. Walk, home run, or strikeout is actually an efficient way to win ball games. It's a very boring game to watch.
Yeah, I miss the old hit and run and stolen bases and all the other stuff.
Use Powerline to promote this. Here's my three simple ways to bring back old baseball. One, take a look at the glove size. You go back and you look at gloves in the classic baseball era, and they protect the hand. Now gloves are finger extenders. They go up like 3 or 4 inches, and you have all these thrilling web catches. But what it means is that it's hard to hit a ball to the gap. It's hard to get a ball through the infield. Singles and doubles turn into outs. Cut 3 inches off the darn glove. Those balls.
Well, that's the way we reduced the pitching mound back in, 1968.
Is increase the pitching mound, give the pitchers that leverage, and three, bring back the high strike. How is it that you used to, for listeners who don't know, and pretty much now, it used to be that at the armpits is where the strike was. Now it's below the breastbone if you're good, and some umpires it's more like the belly button. It's very hard. You get these wham, whiff, or walk batting works when you have a uppercut swing. And it's much easier to get an uppercut swing that drives the ball out of the ballpark when the ball is low, because it's essentially a modified golf swing. You open up those 5 to 6 inches at the top that are strikes. Batters have to put the ball in play. That means fewer home runs. That means more hits. And that means faster baseball. Don't require anything other than like returning to the game's basics before 1961.
Right. You know, I used to say, Henry, that we should just put you in charge of all the Republican campaigns around the country. But now, clearly, that's wrong. We need to make you commissioner of Major League Baseball.
If nominated, I will run. And if elected, I will serve.
All right. Well, thanks, Henry. We will, you know, Churchill's old line is that I forget, it goes something like this. You know, genius is the ability to predict the future and then to explain afterwards why it didn't happen that way. So we'll catch up with you after the election and, you know, see how you did. I'm sure it will be better than Nate Braun's, as I call him. And we'll go on and start setting things up for 2020.
Again, okay.
Right. Thanks. Bye-bye, Henry. Well, there you have it, the lay of the land from Henry Olson, 4 or 5 days out from Election Day. Sounds like it's going to be close. Sounds like it's going to be a mixed bag in terms of results. We'll just have to wait and see. Like baseball, that's why they play the games. I'm going to be traveling on Tuesday, Election Day, back to New York, so I'm going to miss some of the fun and be catching up with things late into the evening. But in the meantime, let me remind you always to please subscribe to the Powerline Show on iTunes or at Ricochet. Please leave us a review. It helps us out in building an audience. Do consider becoming a VIP member of Powerline and also a supporter of our great partners at Ricochet, where memberships start for as little as $2.50 a month and come with lots of great privileges and goodies. I don't have much to add to what Henry had to say. I'll probably write a few things over the weekend on the site about the late-breaking news and odd things happening here and there. And so, really, there's nothing left for me to do now except to remind everyone not to forget to milk the soft power dividend. Bye-bye, everybody. See you next week.
Join the conversation.